We're awarded $1.25 million in fees. The remaining $2.25 million will be used to pay customers who file claims with the bank before December 31st. Individual settlements are expected to range from $25 to $400. Snow in southern Minnesota today. A chance of light snow in central and northeastern sections of the state. Cloudy statewide. Highs today 5 below in the north, near 10 above in the south. The Twin Cities temperature now is 1 and cloudy. That's a news update. I'm Perry Finelli.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, presenting Handel's Messiah with the Minnesota Chorale at multiple Twin Cities locations December 14th through 16th. Ticket information available 651-291-1144.
Good morning. Welcome to Mid-Morning. I'm Catherine Lanfer. Extraordinary is the word that commentators keep using to describe last night's late-night decision issued by the U.S. Supreme Court that effectively hands the presidency to Texas Governor George W. Bush. Here's a word you won't hear: consensus. This was a divided court, agreeing 7-2 that the recount ordered by the Florida State Supreme Court was unconstitutional, but splitting 5-4 on the question of whether there was time to resolve the problems with that recount. No word yet from Vice President Al Gore, and of course we'll bring you the latest developments as they happen. Meanwhile, we'll take your calls and questions as we talk to Jonathan Enten. He's a professor of law and political science at Case Western Reserve University in Ohio. He joins us by phone. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Now, I'd like to get, after wow, I'd like to get sort of your general reaction to last night's ruling.
The most obvious reaction is the court is clearly very badly divided, as you can tell from the tone of some of the opinions. But what struck me in reading the opinions was how close they must have been to a degree of unanimity. Indeed, as you said, 7 of the 9 justices saw that there was a problem with the way the further counting would take place, disagreed over whether you could give a remedy at this stage. If they had been able to agree on some kind of remedy, my hunch is that the other two justices, Stevens and Ginsburg, probably would have gone along for the sake of unanimity. But it's also clear that the prospect of getting unanimity or getting closer to consensus were always pretty slim, because the 5 members of the majority who said it's too late were also the 5 members who voted in favor of stopping the counting on Saturday, then said that the December 12th deadline yesterday was so important, at least it was so important under the view of the Florida legislature, that it was really impractical to spread the count out any further. I'm not sure that that's the only way that they could have come down, and it's clear in the end that whatever efforts were made to get consensus failed.
How do you respond to those who say that this effectively gives the presidency to George W. Bush?
It does. There's no question about that. We may see, in fact, I suspect that Vice President Gore's lawyers have spent the last several hours pouring through the various opinions to try to see whether there is anything left for them to do. My sense is that whatever small window might be there, and I'm not sure there is one, but it's, if there is one, it's so small that I expect later today that Vice President Gore will essentially concede or withdraw or at least indicate that he is not going to press the fight any further.
You mentioned it's talk about the impact of the deadline, the December 12th deadline on the court and its decision. And let me append something to that. We spent an hour yesterday talking to a political scientist who reminded us that deadline is actually rather fuzzy, that in many ways it's not the harsh deadline that especially the media has seemed to fashion it to be.
Well, it depends on how you read the statutes. I don't want to sound like I'm waffling on this, but this is one of those situations. Indeed, it has always been one of those situations where one could really say legitimately there is no controlling legal authority. These laws have never before been put to a judicial test, so we don't know what they mean. We don't have any legal precedents to go on, and they really haven't been tested in Congress, so we don't know from any prior experience really what they mean in that sense. But let me suggest that the December 12th deadline was important because if the Florida electors were determined by December 12th, then under the federal statute that was adopted in the last century following the 1876 fiasco, those electors would be assumed to be the ones from Florida, no questions asked. But if Florida didn't make it by the 12th, they wouldn't lose their electoral votes. However, any electoral votes that came from Florida would be subject to challenge in Congress. We have, as far as I know, only one prior example about how this might have played out. In 1960, on election night, it appeared that Richard Nixon had carried Hawaii over John F. Kennedy. And on the day for casting electoral votes, a group of Nixon electors actually met in Honolulu. However, by then, there was a recount going on that went on past the 12th, past the 18th, into late December. And that recount resulted in a turnaround that Kennedy had, in fact, carried Hawaii. So what happened in Hawaii that year was not only the Nixon electors voted, but so did the Kennedy electors. Both sets of electoral votes were sent to Washington to be opened in that joint session of Congress, presided over by the outgoing Vice President Nixon. And when faced with these two sets of electoral votes, Nixon said, well, I think we should count the votes for Kennedy. No one challenged that ruling. So the votes went to Kennedy. One important difference between that election and this one was the Hawaii electoral votes didn't matter. Kennedy had won the election without them.
Professor Enten, I need to interject here. We just have a report from the Associated Press that Vice President Al Gore has directed his recount committee to suspend activities. And according to his aide, William Daley, he will address the nation this evening. Again, this has just come across the wires. Vice President Al Gore will address the nation this evening. He has asked his recount committee in Florida to suspend activities. We'll, of course, give you more as it comes across the wires here. We're talking to Jonathan Enten. He's a professor of law and political science at Case Western Reserve University in Ohio. We're talking to him about last night's dramatic Supreme Court ruling that has effectively handed the presidency to Texas Governor George W. Bush. If you would like to join this conversation, perhaps you have your own questions about what happened last night, 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828 in the Twin Cities. It's 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Now, Professor Enten, this was a sort of confusing opinion to untangle at first blush, 65 pages, all these different dissents. Let's sort of take it step by step. When the court ruled 7-2 that the recount in Florida, the last recount that was ordered, was unconstitutional, what questions, succinctly, were they answering there?
There were basically two issues before the court. One had to do with whether the process set up by the Florida Supreme Court was sufficiently definite, sufficiently concrete, that we could get an acceptable degree of consistency in the counts from one part of the state to another.
And are we talking uniform standards there?
That's right. They were looking for uniform standards and uniform procedures. And the argument was that the absence of consistent uniform procedures across the state violated the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution, and that's what the seven justices agreed on.
Now, Professor Enten, though, I mean, no state in this union has uniform election processes from county to county. So, I mean, are they in effect saying that all of the procedures in this country are somehow a mess?
That's the question that they have left open. The court tried to say that this was a special circumstance, that, and in effect, if you asked the majority, they would probably say, well, we don't have to answer that question. That wasn't before us. But I think that question is clearly lurking here. Indeed, when the first Bush appeal was filed in the Supreme Court 2 weeks ago, which seems like an eternity now, the Bush people actually pressed this equal protection claim at the time, and the Supreme Court refused even to think about it, which led a lot of people to conclude that the argument really wasn't all that strong. Somehow, since then, a lot of justices became concerned about the inconsistencies.
Professor Enten, I have to interrupt you again. We have this just across from the Associated Press. Vice President Al Gore, his legal fight lost, has decided to drop out of the fiercely contested presidential race with Republican George W. Bush. The Associated Press has learned the two-term Texas governor is set to become America's 43rd president. And, of course, that is all in the aftermath of last night's Supreme Court decision. And when we're not interrupting him with news bulletins, we're talking to Jonathan Enten, professor of law and political science at Case Western Reserve University in Ohio. I'm sorry, Professor Enten, that one sounded pretty important, though.
No, it was, and I think this is pretty much what I expected would happen. We'll see exactly what the vice president says later today or this evening. But we were talking a little bit about this equal protection argument. As I said, most people thought that this was not a particularly strong argument. The court originally didn't even want to hear it. And I think the reason most people thought it wasn't that strong an argument is that traditionally, in order to have an equal protection problem under the Constitution, it's not enough that you say we're treating people somewhat differently. You have to show generally either that the treatment is invidious, that people have been deliberately singled out for bad treatment on the basis of some irrelevant characteristic, or that the law or the policy involved is somehow irrational. There's no conceivable justification for it.
Is it surprising that an argument that no one thought was going to have much merit ends up being the one thing that everyone could agree on, or almost everyone could agree on?
Well, a little bit. After all, since nobody thought this was going to be a very serious argument, what seems to have happened as the process unfolded was that the way these decisions were being made in Florida looked like they were being made up as we went along. Not necessarily that the process was corrupt or necessarily driven by a desire to put Vice President Gore over the top. There clearly some people thought that. But I think that the court's concern may well have been somewhat different, and that is that the Florida election process just seems to be a total shambles, and it's being improvised as we go along. So it's hard to have confidence in the process and in the institutions involved. Now, this gets back to the other piece of equal protection doctrine that turns out to have driven the court and emerged, I think, out of the effort to generate a degree of consensus. Although typically you need to show either that the policy is invidious or irrational, there are cases involving voting in which the Supreme Court has said that the government, the states, have to meet a somewhat higher standard. And that's the line of cases that people who saw this problem on the court analogized to and said the state has to do better than an ad hoc sort of arrangement. Now, what's a little surprising about the equal protection analysis that the court engaged in this case is that, unlike the earlier voting cases, the court this time used that approach really to limit the vote counting process, whereas in the past, when the court said that equal protection applies with greater force in voting than in some other situations, they've used that really to expand voting rights. So some of the criticism that the court may be getting at this point goes to the idea that they've used this equal protection theory to restrict rather than to expand voting rights. Now, people who defend this ruling will say that the majority was essentially trying to protect the integrity of the whole process. But as you said many of the problems in Florida arose because they had not only decentralized the vote counting system, but they decentralized the entire system so that some parts of the state used one kind of technology that seems to have been more prone to errors than other parts of the state.
Well, and let me just try to put this in the simplest language possible. Florida is not unlike any other state. So what is the Supreme Court really saying here? I mean, forget about its impact on the election. They're supposed to be thinking about precedent in general, about principles in general. So are they saying the way we vote in this country is wrong?
They are not necessarily saying that.
Ooh, you're sounding like a lawyer there.
what I mean to say is I'm not sure that say, people in Washington State, which, by the way, ran a very close Senate election using many of the same kinds of voting technology, just went through a recount, and everybody seems to be satisfied with the way it went. I think that they are satisfied not so much because it's a Senate race in the Pacific Northwest rather than the presidency, but because, in fact, Washington State has much better, more comprehensive election rules out there so that everybody kind of knew what was going to happen and how and when. They weren't improvising nearly as much. I think what the court is saying clearly is we ought to be concerned about these disparities in how voting takes place. I don't think the court is saying that these differences are necessarily unconstitutional.
All right. So the first question that they looked at, that they split 7-2 on, was whether the recount itself was constitutional. And using that equal protection argument, they found it unconstitutional.
Right.
But then their other split, 5-4, was on whether, was the question, can we remedy it? Or was the question, do we have time to remedy that?
And the question turned out to be for the five that there was no time to remedy the process because this December 12th deadline was upon us, and the procedures outlined by the Florida Supreme Court simply were in the majority's view inadequate, and so they said we're going to shut down the process now because there's no way to fix it.
All right. And so I guess one question is, what if they hadn't stopped the recount on Saturday? Wasn't it possible that they could have taken the case and allowed the recount to go on?
They could have, but if the problem for the majority of the court was that the recount itself was going under procedures that were constitutionally inadequate, just allowing the count to continue wouldn't have solved the problem. What the majority wanted was a better set of procedures. Now, we should recognize that part of the problem that the Florida Supreme Court had when they ordered the counting to continue without providing any detailed standards was that in the Supreme Court's earlier ruling, there were strong hints that if the Florida Supreme Court said anything beyond the literal words of the Florida election laws, they would be overturned on the ground that they were changing the rules in the middle of the game. Indeed, that was the Bush campaign's second argument in this case, and the majority opinion never gets to that issue. The concurrence by Chief Justice Rehnquist, Justice Scalia, and Justice Thomas deals with that issue, but the majority does not. So I think the problem for the Supreme Court of Florida was they weren't sure that they could do very much without running afoul of this other argument. They really found themselves between a rock and a hard place. They did what they thought they should do and in order to comply with the original ruling, and then it turns out that wasn't good enough. So it's kind of a catch-22 for them.
Let's go to David in Stillwater. David, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Thank you. I am not a happy camper this morning. Not happy with the Supreme Court ruling, which ironically is one of the main reasons I voted for Gore in the first place. Actually, my comment picks up exactly where your guest is speaking right now. It seems to me that the Supreme Court created a legal conundrum for Gore. On the one hand, if the court had spelled out specific uniform standards as to how these votes should be counted, they were going to be accused of writing new laws, and the case would have been thrown out. On the other hand, when they didn't do that, they're accused of violating equal protection. And you know, it's just very disturbing to me the way this has gone.
Well, I think that this is a sentiment that many people will share and will wonder whether there was ever anything that the Florida courts could have done that would have satisfied a majority of the United States Supreme Court. And I think that gets to a point that Justice Breyer made in his dissent, which is that the Supreme Court didn't have to take this case. It didn't have to get involved in this dispute. Once it did get involved in the dispute, I think that there was some real institutional value in their trying to get as close to unanimity as possible. One of the things that concerns me about this decision, aside from whether it's legally correct or not, and I think that there certainly is plenty of room for reasonable people to disagree on that score, but institutionally what strikes me as troubling is the sense that when they split 5-4 on the crucial issue and the split is on ideological lines, that suggests to, or may suggest to some folks that really this was just a political decision and not really based on the law. And that's a recipe for eroding the court's institutional legitimacy. And I think also it's something that will make it very difficult for anybody to get confirmed for the Supreme Court in the foreseeable future who is the least bit controversial.
Well, it sounds like you almost could be talking about Justice Stevens' dissent, which has been quoted widely, although we may never know with complete certainty the identity of the winner of this year's presidential election. The identity of the loser is perfectly clear. It is the nation's confidence in the judge as an impartial guardian of the rule of law.
I think that Justice Stevens has captured a legitimate concern, but let's back up. I mean,
okay.
I think that there...
And also, let me ask you this. Were you... it was funny. Everyone kept talking about Kennedy and O'Connor. To suddenly have Stevens come out with this kind of heat, were you surprised by that at all?
Well, a little bit, but remember that this has been a pretty contentious matter all over the place, and it's certainly been contentious inside the court. I think that Justice Scalia's separate opinion on Saturday in connection with the stay certainly raised some hackles, and not just outside the court. I suspect that some people inside as well. But back in the early 70s, Senator William Proxmire from Wisconsin was sued for issuing his Golden Fleece Award to somebody, and the case wound up in the Supreme Court. So when it was argued, Proxmire went to the argument, and he said he was appalled by the vitriol between or among the justices. And he said, you know, if I said some of the things about my colleagues in the Senate that the justices say about each other, I'd be disciplined. So there is a long history of acrimony in the court.
We are talking to Jonathan Enten. He's a professor of law and political science at Case Western Reserve University in Ohio. We're talking, of course, about last night's late night and extraordinary Supreme Court decision that many say has effectively handed the presidency to Texas Governor George W. Bush. Now, we also need to report to you that according to the Associated Press, Vice President Gore's campaign chair, William Daley, says that Gore will address the nation tonight. Daley also says that the vice president has directed his recount committee in Florida to suspend activities. And the Associated Press reports that two senior advisors, speaking on condition of anonymity, have said that Gore will drop out of the race in his planned address to the nation tonight. We are talking to Professor Enten about all of these developments, focusing on the Supreme Court decision. It's 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828 in the Twin Cities. It's 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Also want to remind you that if you would like to see the Supreme Court ruling, it's posted now on the Minnesota Public Radio homepage. Go to minnesotapublicradio.org and click on our news homepage, and you will find access there to the complete Supreme Court ruling. Meanwhile, we want you to pay attention to Greta Cunningham. She's standing by with the latest from the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. Thanks, Catherine. And the news is breaking fast this morning. As you mentioned, the Associated Press is reporting Al Gore has decided to drop out of the presidential race. Gore's campaign chairman says Gore has directed his recount committee to suspend activities. William Daley says Gore will address the nation this evening. Gore's decision would set the stage for Republican George W. Bush to become the 43rd president of the United States. George W. Bush remains out of sight this morning, but Dick Cheney is at the Bush campaign transition office in Virginia. Neither has commented on the Supreme Court ruling that shut down the Florida presidential recount. Bush aides say he's not going to make a comment on the ruling until Gore responds. No word yet from President Clinton on the latest U.S. Supreme Court ruling on the presidential race. Clinton has been briefed on the ruling as he continues a visit to Northern Ireland. Before the ruling, Clinton said he thought every vote in Florida should be counted. Retail sales fell 0.4% last month, led by the biggest drop in the sale of autos in more than 2 years. The holiday shopping season, meanwhile, hasn't given retailers a lot to cheer about. Retailers report mall traffic is down, sales are soft, and they're worried that the recent snow and cold in the Midwest will hurt sales. In regional news, St. Paul Police Chief William Finney says he won't run for mayor next year. Finney says he has a lot of unfinished business at the police department. He says he intends to complete his 6-year term, which ends in 2004. He says he may possibly seek a third term. St. Paul Mayor Norm Coleman has announced he's not seeking re-election. More than a dozen potential candidates have expressed interest in the job. So far, only former city council member Bobby Meegart has formally announced. The buses were running again this morning in the Robbinsdale School District. Union workers overwhelmingly approved a tentative agreement yesterday that called off their week-long strike. The deal includes a 12.7% increase in pay and benefits over 2 years. The forecast for Minnesota today calls for snow likely in the south with a chance of light snow in central and northeastern Minnesota. Mostly cloudy statewide today with highs ranging from 5 below zero in the north to near 10 above in the south. At this hour, Duluth reports clear skies, a temperature of 9 below zero. It's cloudy with a temperature of zero in Rochester. And in the Twin Cities, cloudy skies, a temperature of 1 above. That's a look at the latest news.
Thanks to the more than 7,000 members who joined or renewed their membership to Minnesota Public Radio during our last membership drive.
I'm Lorna Benson. On the next All Things Considered, we'll have all the latest presidential news, analysis, and commentary from National Public Radio, plus local reaction to the election saga. Tune in for All Things Considered from 3 to 6:30 here on Minnesota Public Radio, KNOW FM 91.1 in the Twin Cities.
I'm Catherine Lanfer. You're listening to Mid-Morning. We're talking, of course, about last night's U.S. Supreme Court decision and how it effectively handed the presidency to Texas Governor George W. Bush. We're trying to focus on the actual legal ruling in this hour. In the second half of Mid-Morning, we'll be talking about more of the political implications. We'll take your calls and questions both hours at 1-800-242-2828. And in the Twin Cities, 651-227-6000. We're continuing our conversation with Jonathan Enten. He's a professor of law and political science at Case Western Reserve University in Ohio. Let's go to Melissa. She's calling us from Minneapolis. Melissa, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Thank you, and thank you so much for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question for the professor. If the Gore people had also raised the issue of equal protection regarding the voting machines and the inequities between the different counties, would that have been something that the Supreme Court would have had to address as well?
Well, if they had, I mean, the real question, I suppose, is how procedurally that issue would have been raised. But I think you've identified something. I mean, what's at issue here is the argument that the way the votes are being counted under this process violates equal protection, but the disparities in how all of the votes were cast and counted seem to be much greater than the way the undervotes are being counted. And so one of the questions that we talked about a little bit earlier is, I mean, lurking in this opinion is the notion that these having punch cards in one county and paper ballots in another and optical scanners in a third may itself raise equal protection questions, because those systems are, some of them are more reliable and more accurate than others. And I think that these questions are now legitimately on the table, even though the majority of the court is trying to tell us that that's really not what this case is about. But I think if we're going to go to equal protection, then we have to, for the undervotes, then it seems to me we have to think in equal protection terms about the rest of the process as well.
Let's go to Laura. She's in St. Paul. Laura, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Thank you. I was wondering if Professor Endon can describe why there's disagreement even among the Supreme Court justices between whether December 12th or December 18th is the deadline for the electors being chosen for the state of Florida.
Well, there clearly is disagreement about that. The majority thinks that December 12th is crucial for this so-called safe harbor, that is to insulate the Florida electors from challenge in Congress. But as I indicated earlier, the votes need to be cast on the 18th. If we didn't have a resolution by the 12th, the only question at issue would have been, would somebody in Congress challenge the Florida electoral vote simply because it wasn't resolved conclusively by the 12th? As I indicated earlier, in Hawaii in 1960, it wasn't actually resolved until, I think, December 29th. So what happened there was two sets of electors voted sort of on a precautionary basis, and both sets were sent to Congress, and Vice President Nixon made the determination without any real debate in Congress. So it's not clear that December 12th was as crucial as the opinion suggests, but the majority says that they don't have to resolve that because the Florida legislature had given evidence that it thought that December 12th was crucial and that it wanted to get things resolved by then. That may or may not be correct, but that's the way the majority read it.
Why wasn't the majority opinion signed?
Well, often when you have either a very short period for deciding or the issues are complicated, the court will issue the opinion per curiam, that is, in the name of the court. That's a way of saying this is an institutional statement. Now, the difficulty is that a per curiam in a major case like this one would be more effective if everybody or virtually everybody signed on. But in fact, only two justices, Kennedy and O'Connor, seem to agree with everything in the per curiam opinion. You've got Rehnquist, Scalia, and Thomas writing separately, saying that, well, they agree with that, but they also think that there were other problems. And then you have the four dissenters. So, I think that the court was trying to speak as an institution, but obviously the court was so badly divided that that didn't really hold up very well.
And what's the impact of all that division?
Well, I think if anything, it raises questions for people outside the court about what to make of this decision. I mean, the court seems to have taken this case on the theory that it's a big, important, controversial issue. It raises some legal and constitutional questions, and it's up to the Supreme Court to make the final call. But when it turns out that the court itself can't agree, then perhaps we have to wonder whether the court got it right. And that's the institutional concern that we touched on earlier in the dissents by Justice Stevens and Justice Breyer.
What impact will this have for future elections, do you think?
Well, one thing that it might do is to persuade people that their votes really matter. They better get out and vote because every vote counts, and the presidency here turned on a handful of votes in one state. I think that another thing that this may do is to get real attention paid to the process by which we vote and count the votes. Voting and elections are a kind of stepchild in government these days. People don't pay that much attention to it, and it turns out that we have all these problems.
But it strikes me that after this ruling, we could have literally hundreds of equal protection cases blossoming around the country.
I think that there's a real possibility of that, even though the majority opinion in the Supreme Court try to say, no, we're not trying to open up this Pandora's box, this can of worms. This is a unique situation. But I think it's going to be very difficult to limit the equal protection analysis that the court used here just to this one contest.
Well, for instance, we had Jamie Raskin from American University. We were talking to him yesterday, and he suggested that the African Americans in Florida who are particularly angry about how their votes were handled, they should pursue an equal protection case.
Well, I think that there are many questions about the way African Americans and Haitians were treated in Florida. Florida has a long and unfortunate history about segregation and discrimination, and certainly the places where the undervote was disproportionately concentrated tended to be more heavily minority. So I think that there already has been concern about this, and I think we will see more discussion about it. But the question, even if these claims are brought at this point, they're not going to change the outcome of the election. They might result in some kind of legal sanctions being placed against the parties responsible for depriving African Americans and Haitians of their voting rights, if that can be established by the appropriate levels of evidence. And it may also lead to attempts to reform Florida election laws and practices. And if there's anything that comes out of all of this, the people in Florida ought to be embarrassed about how messy and how badly drafted their election laws are. I mean, these are things that ought to be of concern to everyone.
Well,
I say that living in an area that has had its own problems with election law.
Well, I was just going to ask you, was this election and thus the nation the victim of bad law?
Well, I think partly that's been the problem in Florida, and as I said, I suspect that's been true in some other places as well.
Well, and of course, you were saying earlier that elections have frequently been the stepchild. So, in other words, we are victims of our own neglect?
I think in some ways that's true.
All right, let's go to Dennis in St. Paul. Welcome to Mid-Morning, Dennis.
Well, thank you. I think this whole thing stinks to high heaven. I believe that Gore won the national election, and I also believe that he won in Florida. And I don't think I'm alone with that. I think the Bush people believe that, too, because their major strategy has been to employ a whole series of delay ninjas. They don't care what they argue as long as it delays the count. And now they've hijacked the Supreme Court to do that. I'm not surprised, really, that Rehnquist and company would do that. I'm surprised at how clumsily they did it. I say shame on O'Connor and Kennedy.
Okay.
Shame, shame, shame.
All right. Professor Anton?
Well, I think that part of the problem is that neither campaign was necessarily looking for the truth. They were both looking to win and were prepared to make whatever sorts of legal arguments were passed the giggle test, really, that would advance their positions. It may well be that what should have happened, I think what should have happened is one of two things. Either, perhaps they should have rerun the election in Florida on the theory that we would never get the true count. That's probably unrealistic. Given that we couldn't do a revote in Florida, it seems to me that the next best thing would have been to do a statewide hand recount to make sure that we got as close to the accurate count as we could.
But you still would have run into...
Neither side really asked for that.
But, Professor Anton, even if we had done a manual recount, you still would have had the question of uniform standards.
Well, maybe if people had sat down early enough and said, let's do this recount and let's agree on the standards ahead of time, we would have more confidence. I mean, it's clear enough that a lot of these ballots are going to be looked at. They're not going to be looked at by official election counters. They're going to be looked at by reporters and scholars and interest groups because Florida has a a very generous open records law.
All right.
Public documents, and people will look at them.
We're talking to Jonathan Enten. He's a professor of law and political science at Case Western Reserve University in Ohio. We'd like to remind you that, according to the Associated Press, Vice President Gore will address the nation tonight. According to his campaign chair, William Daley, the vice president has directed the recount committee that he has in Florida to suspend activities. The Associated Press also tells us that two senior advisors, speaking on condition of anonymity, have said that Gore will drop out of the race in his planned address to the nation tonight. Now, meanwhile, we have no comment from Texas Governor George W. Bush on the U.S. Supreme Court ruling, but it is said that he hopes to speak to the nation about his quest for the presidency soon. Well, we would like to speak to you soon if you'd like to join our conversation on the Supreme Court ruling. It's 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. In the Twin Cities, it's 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. We're going to go to Ellen in St. Joseph. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Yes, good morning.
Hi.
And thank you for taking my call. I just have a comment. It seems to me that Governor Bush didn't really win the election. He won a court case, barely. I'd like the professor to comment on that, and I'll hang up and listen.
All right.
It's true that Governor Bush won a court case, but I think we will. One of the problems with stopping the count is that we won't ever really know. It's not at all clear whether Gore would have carried Florida if all of these controversial ballots were looked at. I don't know. I think the Bush people are concerned that he would have that Gore would have taken the state. Gore certainly hopes he would have, but I'm not sure that we know enough to be able to say with any great confidence. And I think, as I was saying earlier, these ballots are public documents in Florida, and so they will be looked at. We may have a tremendous amount of debate about them because some people are going to look at them using one approach to let count as a valid vote, and other people will use different standards, and it may well be that who won Florida will depend on what standards we use. We will never know for sure, any more than we know with absolute confidence who really won the election of 1876, 124 years after the fact. We have a lot of arguments. There are some views about that, but we don't really know absolutely who won that election, and we will probably never know for sure who won this one.
Let's go to Ken in Rochester. Ken, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
I'm a little bit concerned by this claim that this was a conservative decision by the Supreme Court. The vote was 7-2 that the Florida Supreme Court had violated the Equal Protection Clause, and that included two liberal justices. Plus, it had gone through the Florida court system, and the Florida Supreme Court had a 4-3 decision. Three people dissented and said they didn't feel that what they were doing in Florida was consistent with the Constitution. So I don't think this was some court-packing conservative decision.
Well, the question I think for a lot of people is whether this decision can be justified in traditional sorts of legal doctrinal terms, and that's a close call for a lot of people. That's part of what was dividing the court. The people who see this as ideologically driven will say that the most conservative justices thought that this was really troublesome and there was no remedy possible, and that the two who saw the two more liberal justices who saw that there was a problem thought that we ought to do something about it. And so I suppose in some ways it depends on whether you're looking at the bottom line or at the reasoning. But Carr is absolutely right. That seven justices saw that there was an equal protection problem, they just couldn't agree about what to do about it. I think that we should not be surprised that feelings are running high, though. This is the first time in American history when the Supreme Court has actually decided a case that effectively resolved a presidential election. And when you're dealing with that sort of situation and where the election came down to one state, there's going to be a lot of strong feelings here.
We want to remind everyone that if they'd like to see the entire Supreme Court ruling, it's on the Minnesota Public Radio News homepage. How do you get there? MinnesotaPublicRadio.org, and go to the news homepage. Meanwhile, we're going to go to Tamara in Minneapolis. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Well, thank you for having me. I want to point out one thing. That previous caller is being very disingenuous, to use as mild a term as I can without pounding my fist through the radio. But he's only mentioning the first decision, which I suspect was the decision that Scalia sprung on the liberal justice right away, which was a nice, simple remand. Not an overturning, but a remand, which is essentially go back and try again. However, the decision, which is the important one, the bitterly divided one, was where Scalia said, no, you're not going to be allowed to start up the recount again because there's no time. Of course, cleverly failing to state that the whole reason there is no time is because Scalia stopped the count Saturday. And to go to my original point, I mean, isn't it ironic that the Florida Supreme Court, the whole reason they did not set a mandatory standard was precisely because they were trying like crazy to avoid being accused of legislating from the bench. And so here the Supreme Court, with Justice Scalia dictating the majority opinion, has essentially said, you were wrong because you should have legislated from the bench. I mean, these people were literally darned if you do and darned if you don't, because I think Scalia would have found a way to rule against them no matter what.
All right. Thank you. Professor?
Well, I think that the caller is right that the Florida Supreme Court thought it was caught between a rock and a hard place, and that if they did anything but repeat the statutory formula, they would be slapped down for judicial activism. I do think, however, that we shouldn't make Justice Scalia the villain in all of this. Justice Scalia is very conservative. He makes no bones about his views, but he's only one of nine justices. I don't think it's fair to say that Scalia was dictating the outcome here. He had four colleagues who agreed with him, and I think those folks are sufficiently strong-willed on their own that we ought not to, if we don't like the decision, we shouldn't just blame it on Scalia. We should blame it on the people we think were wrong, not just on the one person who has the highest profile.
We want to remind you again that Vice President Al Gore is expected to address the nation tonight. According to his campaign chair, William Daley, he has asked his recount committee in Florida to suspend activities. And according to the Associated Press, two senior advisors, speaking on condition of anonymity, have said that Gore will drop out of the race in his planned address to the nation tonight. We haven't heard anything from Texas Governor George W. Bush, but we know that he would like to speak to the nation soon, according to comments, again, that we're getting from the Associated Press. Let's go to Michael in Minneapolis. Michael, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Good morning.
Hello, Michael.
Hi. Yeah, doing childcare at the same time here.
Okay.
Thank you. Well, my concern is that, my feeling is that the Supreme Court has done what they asked the Florida court not to do, which is to rewrite the laws after the case. And in this case, since they found that the rules are not being followed that they've written now, that they're just saying, okay, and we'll go on to the next election. And if somebody went and robbed a bank, and we said, oh, that's against the laws, but the next time we're going to do something about that.
Well, I think that a lot of people don't see every step of the reasoning in the court's opinion as following all that clearly from prior cases. But I suppose we should remember what another justice said in a very different setting, which was, we're not final because we're infallible. We're infallible because we're final. I mean, the Supreme Court is the last stop in terms of interpreting the meaning of the Constitution. Doesn't mean that we all have to agree with it, with what they say. This was clearly a hard-fought election, and I think that it's unfortunate that the election has wound up being tossed into the lap of the Supreme Court and having the Supreme Court having such a hard time itself coming to any kind of agreement on what to do. I think that as a practical matter, there isn't anything further that can be done at this point. I mean, the election is for all practical purposes over, and it's not that we should necessarily forget what's happened as much as we should learn from what happened to try to figure out how to avoid falling into this kind of situation in the future.
Let's go to Ken in Plymouth. Ken, welcome to Mid-Morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
I think you're, and I hope everybody can just take a deep breath and listen to what I'm going to say. You're missing the point of the ruling. The ruling was that when Boies was asked by one of the justices, so you can have the same punch card ballot in the same canvassing board room at a different table determined differently. That was the problem. It's not that one uses a punch card ballot and one uses a different method. It's not the difference of methods. It's the difference of judging the same ballot in the same room in the same county. And if they were to avoid this mess, they could have done it way back when, if the canvassing boards in the state of Florida would have got together and said, okay, these are the punch ballots, this is what we got to do to clear, to make it legally stick. The canvassing boards, from what I understand, are the only ones that have the authority, because if you'd went to the Supreme Court of Florida or the legislature, you'd have been changing the law after the election started. But the canvassing boards did have the authority to make that judgment. If they'd have made it in unison, it would have held up.
All right, Ken, we're near the end here, and I want to make sure that I give the professor time to respond and we get one more call. Professor?
Okay, I think that statement of Florida law is not necessarily right. I think the concern isn't that people on the same canvassing board would disagree. I mean, if that were true, then hand counting would violate equal protection, because one person or one team might read the same ballot card differently than another. I think the concern that the court had more than human variation was that there were different standards being applied in different counties, and they thought that was a problem because some counties were being more generous in counting votes and some were not, and they saw that as a bigger problem.
Matthew and Shoreview, you have to be brief, but
okay.
Okay.
Looking at the future, are hand recounts pretty much in danger of constantly being overturned this way? And if so, what's the effect on civil rights legislation and voters' rights legislation?
Okay. I would be very surprised if hand recounting is unconstitutional. And one of the reasons I say that is that you may recall that in New Mexico, for example, and for that matter in Texas and a number of other states, hand recounting has been done and has been done sometimes at the behest of Republicans. So I'm not sure that we can go that far. I think there may be some people on the Supreme Court who would like to go that far, but I don't think that there's anything like a majority for that view.
All right. Professor Enten, we've run out of time, and I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Jonathan Enten is a professor of law and political science at Case Western Reserve University in Ohio. And again, want to give you the latest from the Associated Press. Vice President Al Gore will announce in an address to the nation tonight that he will drop out of the presidential race. Meanwhile, Texas Governor George W. Bush has declined to comment this morning on the U.S. Supreme Court ruling that has effectively handed him the presidency. But he said that he hopes to speak to the nation soon about his quest for the presidency. I'm Catherine Lanfer. You're listening to Mid-Morning here on Minnesota Public Radio. Today's programming is made possible in part by the Advocates of Minnesota Public Radio. Contributors include Northeastern Minnesota Gunflint Trail Association, vacations of a different nature, on the web at gunflint-trail.com.
I remember this one from back when I was just a boy.
Wherever you look, the picture is grim. Inventories are piling up. Christmas sales look bad. Housing is off. New equipment sales are way off. The NASDAQ has lost half its value.
I'm David Brancaccio. What if he's talking about recession? That later today on Marketplace from PRI.